Marco Rubio met with Sergey Lavrov yesterday. And interestingly, the readout on the American side was merely that a meeting took place and that they talked about the Russia-Ukraine war. That's it. It was like two sentences long, very short. But on the Russian side, Dmitry Peskov was asked this morning how the Russians view that.
In this situation, I wouldn't be overly optimistic. Contacts are indeed taking place. That is always positive. That is always positive. But one cannot speak of any new dynamics or acceleration right now. Now, we continue our dialogue with the Americans through existing working channels. And we hope that when the American negotiators are freer, we will continue in-person communication. They will be able to come to Moscow and continue our dialogue.
Now, the Russians have said of late, Sergey Lavrov and Vladimir Putin both, that they are very disappointed that the spirit of Anchorage from Trump's the first time when he had the rolled out the red carpet is effectively dead and there's nothing more to it. So why do you suppose that Sergey Lavrov would agree to meet Rubio, and what do they actually expect to happen?
I think that he met with him because he wants to show that he is a responsible diplomat who's open to diplomacy. He's willing to meet with the American Secretary of State. This all shows that Russia is a responsible actor, responsible stakeholder in the international system. But in terms of actually expecting anything from the Americans, the Russians at this point in time don't expect anything from the Americans. They know that you can't trust Marco Rubio or President Trump any further than you can throw them. These are people who speak out of both sides of the mouth, who reach agreements and then violate those agreements. The Russians understand that they're basically at war with the United States, and what they have to do is go to great lengths to make sure that the United States loses in Iran. That's in Russia's interest. And furthermore, that Russia wins in the Ukraine war, and that Russia delivers the United States twin defeats. This is what the Russians are thinking, for sure. You want to remember, Danny, that at the G7 meetings that President Trump attended in France, the members of the G7 said afterwards in a declaration that they were going to accelerate their assistance to Ukraine in its waging of the long-range drone campaign against Russia. And furthermore, they made it explicit in the declaration that they were going to ramp up efforts to damage the Russian economy. This is the G7 countries, including the United States of America. Then you had in early July the NATO meetings in Ankara. And again, President Trump was there. And again, he and the NATO allies made it clear that they still had their gun sights on Russia, and they were going to do everything they could to make sure that Ukraine lost, that Russia lost in the Ukraine war, and would hopefully be weakened to the point where it was knocked out of the ranks of the great powers. This is what the United States is up to. Despite what President Trump or Marco Rubio says from time to time, it's quite clear that we have our gun sights on the Russians, and the Russians fully understand that, and they will act accordingly, which is not to say that you won't get this occasional diplo speak from people like Sergey Lavrov, because this kind of soft power is in Russia's advantage.
And speaking of the war there, because I think it's the most likely outcome is going to be the literal inverse of what you said the U.S. had hoped to do, which was to knock Russia out of the power, out of the ranks of the great powers. We may end up knocking ourselves out. But I want to look at something more on the operational, not the granular level so far. So far up to this point, but there has been over the last month or so, one of the major themes in the Western media has been a turning point has been achieved. Now then, because of these long range strikes and like into the Wildberries, us. They're basically their Amazon supply chains, whatever. Big, huge, spectacular fires, black smoke everywhere, refineries being hit, other military targets deep inside of Russia, and apparently Russia is not able to stop them. That's the implication. So a turning point has been reached. But then here in just the last week or 10 days, we saw that all of a sudden Ukraine has fired their prime minister, they fired their defense minister, and now they fired their general commander, General Sersky. So what do you make of all these turnovers? Because if you're winning, seems like that would be a bad time to overturn these key players.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree with that. When you see Sersky and the defense minister both fired, you just sort of say to yourself, wow, you don't want to do this in the middle of a war unless you absolutely have to. My sense as to what was happening here is that there was a fight between the defense minister and Sersky that involved strategy for the war. When the defense minister was appointed about 6 months ago, he more or less had two missions. One was to deal with the manpower problem. As we both know, the Ukrainians have a huge manpower problem. They have so many draft dodgers and so many people who are in the wall that they just don't have enough fighting forces up on the front lines. And the new defense minister was supposed to solve that problem. And in addition, he was going to go to work on the long-range drone attacks against Ukraine, excuse me, against Mother Russia. Now, what happened is that he did not solve the manpower problem. The manpower problem is worse than ever. In fact, the last time I was on the show, I believe you showed some clips of riots in the western part of Ukraine, in the city of Lviv. So the defense minister did not solve that problem, and that causes problems for Sersky, because he needs increased numbers of troops. The other thing is, I think that there is a tension between waging a long-range drone war deep into Russia on one hand, and number two, employing large numbers of drones on the front lines. And I think the emphasis on using long-range drones that the defense minister favored was causing problems for Sersky up on the front lines. So Sersky was facing two problems. One, he wasn't getting enough troops. The manpower problem wasn't coming close to being solved. And number two, I think that you have a finite number of drones, and he was having trouble getting his fair share of those drones, because there was so much interest in the long-range drone campaign. And I think those sort of strategic or military considerations caused lots of tension between the two of them. They had two different strategies in mind on how to wage the war. One emphasized the long-range drone program, and the other, or long-range drone campaign, and the other fighting up on the front lines. And I think that led to significant tensions between the two of them. They might not have liked each other on personal grounds anyway, and you got a real conflict going here. And Zelensky ended up in a situation where he had to fire both of them. He fired the defense chief first, but that caused all sorts of protests because people really liked the defense chief. And I think that's in large part because they thought the long-range drone campaign was a winning strategy. And furthermore, it did not involve Ukrainian casualties. Whereas Sersky, because he's up on the front lines and huge numbers of Ukrainians are being killed on the front lines, he's not going to be very popular compared to the defense minister. So I think in the end, Zelensky really ended up in a situation where he had no choice but to fire both of them. And this is not a good situation
It's not a good situation. And I think, as we have both concluded, it's not going to make any difference who is in those positions, and whoever they replace them with, it's not going to be any more successful. In the last bit of time we have here, I wonder if you can tell us the collusion, I guess, between these two, or the nexus between these two wars in the Middle East and here, and what the impact on what we've discussed earlier on the Iran war could have here. Because if Zelensky has been begging, he wants a Patriot interceptor, a factory built there. He said they're going to do something. That's years down the road. But they're at war right now. They're already having, again, to look at what's going to happen energy-wise for the winter, and are they going to be able to survive that again? But now then, there's going to be even fewer air defense missiles available because we're burning through them at all. We're not going to have any to give to them at all, and maybe not even any of the longer-range missiles, et cetera. And with the price of oil going up and the price of everything concurrently going up as well, we're going to be focused on trying to get that solved. What impact is that going to have on the actual conduct of this war?
Well, I'm basically from the Ted Postal school when it comes to talking and thinking about defensive missiles. I'm not sure those Patriots were doing much anyway. I mean, the implication of the discourse about the Patriots is that if the Ukrainians were able to get their hands on large numbers of Patriots, they'd be able to shoot down the vast number of ballistic missiles and cruise missiles and drones that the Russians are targeting Ukraine with. I actually don't believe that. But it's irrelevant because the fact is we don't have Patriot missiles to give to the Ukrainians. So they're not going to get the Patriot missiles, and there are no real meaningful substitutes here. So what you see, if you look at what's going on in Ukraine now, is that the Russians are pretty much free to attack any target in Ukraine, and they don't have to worry at all about a Patriot missile or any other kind of missile knocking down the incoming missiles or the incoming drones. So what you see is that Ukraine is highly vulnerable, and the Russians have a huge inventory of bombs and missiles and drones, and they are really pounding Ukraine. And I think most importantly, at this point in time, is the campaign in Odessa. And it looks to me like the Russians have basically cut off Odessa as a port of exit for Ukraine. Ukraine sells lots of its grain and wheat through Odessa, but that's no longer possible because the Russians have done so much damage to the port in Odessa. And I think what's happening here, and is going to continue to happen, is that the Russians are going to use their massive advantage in air power to continue to pound Ukraine. And this, coupled with the trouble that Ukraine is having on the battlefield because of its lack of manpower, I think guarantees that the Russians are going to win this war, number one. And number two, that Ukraine is going to emerge as a dysfunctional rump state.
Yeah.
So this is all disastrous for the Ukrainians.
And so let me ask you, in like 30 seconds or less, what about the economics? Because everything in Ukraine is only kept alive because of European money. But with the disaster going on in the Gulf and the rising of the cost of energy, Russia's now getting more flush with cash because of the rise of that. And it's costing more to do business in Europe, and they're already pretty weak economically. Do you see any concerns about that in terms of how they can support going forward Ukraine?
Well, I think there's no question that what's happening in Iran is going to have a seriously negative effect on the price of oil and gas in Europe and cause big trouble for those economies. And I think the politics in Europe are likely to change over time and erode support for Ukraine in some important ways. And this means that Ukraine will get less help from Europe over time. You can already see evidence of that happening. And by the way, in terms of material support, this has already happened with the United States. So I think events in Iran and just the course of the war between Ukraine and Russia is creating a situation where Ukraine's future looks highly bleak.
Indeed. Couldn't put it better myself. Thank you so much for coming on today. Always a delight to have you on. We really appreciate it. And be sure to send people back to mearsheimer.substack.com to keep up with all the stuff that Professor publishes there. Always great stuff. I was looking at it just earlier today. Thank you so much for coming on. Always appreciate you.
Thank you for having me, Danny. My pleasure.
And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes more with former State Department official Matthew Ho. He's going to be taking a look at some things that are having to do with the U.S. Domestic issue, but as it relates to national security and foreign policy, and especially has to do with this whole issue of tying America's national security and intelligence to a third country. I bet you'll never guess which one it is. Join us today with Matt Ho here in just a few minutes on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You know we don't have sponsors because we hate to hit you over the head with ads. I don't like them. So show a little love back. Subscribe, like, and send this to somebody you care about.